This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, the Portland metro area's independent, no advertising, and community-powered radio station. It's time for the Old Mole Variety Hour, where each Monday morning, our collective of agitator moles provide interviews, reviews, and views that challenge the status quo and encourage greater understanding, reflection, and action. I'm your host, Laurie Mercier, and Carlos Chavez is engineering. On today's show, we discuss how powerful interests are threatening our water, our land, our schools, our jobs, and our lives, and how people are mobilizing to protect the planet and create a more just world. The nature and logic of capitalism are incorrigibly avaricious. Always seeking new ways to make money, capitalists have reinvented the system many times in the past 200 years. Each incarnation has featured new brands of exploitation and corruption, redesigned and packaged to distract and seize control. Working people have won hard-fought gains to rein in the worst excesses of capital, but however ingenious or effective the reforms, they've been limited, if not eventually subverted, by the intractably mercenary nature of capitalism. As we see from the history of the past 40 years, an era that has been marked by a transatlantic assault on social democracy, the rage to accumulate remains the predatory heart and soul of capitalism. We have good reason to assume that capitalists will always seek and find fresh ways to cast off the fetters and vanquish their opponents. As David McNally asserts in his book, Monsters of the Market, Zombies, Vampires, and Global Capitalism, capital seeks to make us into lifeless, disempowered agents of alien powers detached from labor's value. Conscripting us into an economic war, capitalism turns us into soldiers of fortune, ransacking the earth to fill the shelves and banks with plunder. Here on The Old Mole, we not only engage in a critique of what's wrong with capitalism's hold on us, but we address the question, what do we really want, in exploring vibrant social movements of our day and the wellsprings of radical hope. On today's show, Bill Resnick speaks with Brian Jones, New York City activist, teacher, and filmmaker, on the assault on the public schools, the motives of the hedge funds and billionaires leading the way, and the actual needs of kids in low-income schools, including a pedagogy of the oppressed. Jones will be in Portland on Friday to tell us more about how we can stop the assault on our schools. Next, I'll speak with Stephanie Penn Spear, founder and executive director of EcoWatch, and about the top environmental stories of 2012 and how to mobilize to save the planet in 2013. Fran Michelle reviews David McNally's Monsters of the Market, Zombies, Vampires, and Global Capitalism, and the movie moles Denise Morris and Jan Hocken will offer a feminist analysis of the recent Newtown, Connecticut shooting and the larger issue of gun violence, beginning with a discussion of Michael Moore's film Bowling for Columbine of some years back. At the end of the show, Bill Resnick talks to Jacob Devaney, founder and director of Culture Collective and contributor to the Huffington Post, about recent struggles of First Nations Canadian women to prevent corporations from weakening Indigenous treaty rights in their drive to exploit Canadian resources. Of course, you can hear all of this and more anytime on the KBOO Old Mole website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Now here is Bill Resnick speaking with Brian Jones.
Brian Jones, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Jones is an eloquent defender of public education. He also discusses how the schools could become engaging and stimulating and wonderful places for our children that deserve schools like that. And he's a critic of the boy billionaires who want to privatize and powerful critic. Brian Jones, tell us a little about your background, and lots of our listeners probably know of you in one way or another.
I am a teacher and activist, have sometimes worked as an actor. I have been an elementary school teacher in New York City's public schools for 9 years, 8 years in Harlem, last year in Brooklyn. I co-narrated a film called The Inconvenient Truth Behind Waiting for Superman. And I'm part of a group here in New York called the Movement of Rank and File Educators, which is the social justice caucus of our union, the United Federation of Teachers. So I am coming to Portland
to talk on schools. This is sort of a little taste of what you're going to say. So give us a sketch of your critique of the boy billionaires who are trying to privatize education and basically end the public schools.
Right. Well, the problem, as I see it, is that we have some of our society's wealthiest and most powerful people have decided to remake public education in their own image, transform any semblance of democratic governance into a more top-down portfolio management model of management, and to have what they call a results, quote-unquote, driven model, a data-driven model, which really means, at the end of the day, high-stakes standardized test scores. And so we've gone from an era in which those scores were used to wrongly, I would argue, evaluate learning, to now use them to also evaluate teaching, and now to use them to make personnel decisions, and use them to open and close schools. And so the stakes of these high-stakes standardized tests have been raised, raised, and raised, all out of proportion to the actual usefulness of that data.
It's also been set up to make sure that the schools appear to be failures.
Absolutely.
The public schools in the United States that have created, probably the most, that have built and contributed to the creation of really an enormously creative and effective working group of working people at every level, are being dismantled in the name of this sort of corporate efficiency and testing model.
Well, importantly, what's so brilliant in a way about what's happening, not brilliant from our perspective, but really brilliant from their perspective, is that all of this occurs in the name of quality and in the name of demanding higher quality and higher standards. So in the name of improving the school and demanding excellence, they are in fact narrowing education, watering it down to something that can be easily measured. And so we face all kinds of insane dilemmas, such as if a reading passage is actually interesting, then it's not fair to say that there are correct answers about its meaning and its lessons. But if a passage is stale and boring and flat and one-dimensional, then it suddenly is fair because it does have right and wrong answers, but it no longer becomes worthwhile literature. And it certainly isn't worthwhile to subject children to reading literature like that over and over again for weeks and weeks and teach them that that's what reading is about. Yeah. In the name of raising standards and increasing excellence, they've actually narrowed it and reduced our horizon.
This is Bill Resnick for The Old Mole. I'm interviewing Brian Jones, a critic of corporate, quote, reform models in education. He's going to be speaking this Friday at 5 at the Redeemer Lutheran Church, 5431 Northeast 20th. That's this Friday at 5, in fact, until 6:30 at the Redeemer Lutheran Church. And you can hear a whole lot more of his critique, as well as it's one of the great things about what I understand about your position and your talks and your writing is that you have taught in the schools and you have personal knowledge as well as a considerable background in what could be wonderful and engaging schools. Why don't you describe those?
Yes, and I think it's really important to acknowledge that we also share dissatisfaction with public education as it is. And we have been arguing that especially schools for lower-income children, schools for people of color, have been, in many cities, of an inferior quality. And we stand with parents and students in those communities who are trying to have higher quality schools in raising those demands and insisting that we can have it. In my view, that the kind of education that we really want for all of our children is not something that is so easily measured and quantified. But when you ask what it looks like, in my mind, it looks like a humane environment with small classes where students get lots of opportunity to talk and to listen, to be heard and to hear, and where there is great opportunity for them to pursue their own interests and passions. Instead of trying to apply some kind of cookie-cutter curriculum to every single child, every single week, on the same lesson and the same standard, you know, on the same pacing calendar everywhere in the universe, you know, I think we ought to have some idea that children are different. They're interested in different things. And through a combination of broadening their horizons and challenging them to try new things and listening and responding to their own needs, interests, concerns and passions, that together we can take their natural curiosity and desire for learning and help them grow into the kinds of people that they could be.
Including, in fact, for students doing projects, producing things for their community.
Absolutely.
Producing beautiful things that they can present to other people. It seems
Absolutely.
To me that that's what a school should be.
Of course.
And that isn't it's nothing like that. In fact, the corporate model is radically different. They
right.
don't want people investigating their community, talking to their elders. They want right. them to be obedient and do what they're told.
One year I was the drama teacher in my school in East Harlem. I taught drama to ages, to grades second through fifth. And at the end of the year, we put on a whole bunch of plays that they had written. And I think it was fairly obvious to anyone who was there, what the children learned. These were their plays. There were many, many plays that we put on. But to try to quantify that result, to try to boil it down to something that could be visible on a spreadsheet in some central office somewhere, is an enterprise that we have just been pursuing ad absurdum. And the whole idea that these personnel decisions, that teaching and learning can be evaluated from afar via spreadsheet, is really, in my view, all about taking the power and decision-making and autonomy away from the school community and raising it to the level of management. And it's, again, in the name of quality, it actually hurts authentic teaching and learning. There is a way that we can raise the quality, but it actually requires giving more power over to teachers, and I would argue giving more power over to parents, and I would argue it's about giving more power over to students, so that we all together hold each other accountable in the process of trying to develop the best possible practices for teaching and learning and respond to our needs as a community. But in my mind, that's the kind of vision of education that we need to fight for. At this moment in time, that is going to require a broad defense of public education. Teachers' unions are going to have to fight to defend teachers and defend their right to exist and reach out and extend a hand of solidarity to parents and to students in our common interests and fight for some kind of a vision, a democratic vision of public education that is, in my mind, greatly different from corporate image of reform that we are experiencing right now.
Brian Jones, thanks so much for talking to us, and you hear more from Brian Jones this Friday at 5 o'clock at the Redeemer Lutheran Church, 5431 Northeast 20th. Look forward to seeing you, Brian.
Thanks, Bill.
Right, so long.
See you then. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Bill Resnick and Brian Jones. With me on the phone right now is Stephanie Penn Spear, founder, executive director, and editor of EcoWatch. Spear chairs the Renewable Energy Committee for Sustainable Cleveland 2019 and is on the advisory board for the Lake Erie Waterkeeper, Green City Blue Lake Institute, Tri-Seas Green Academy and Center for Sustainability, and Sunflower Solutions. Welcome to KBOO, Stephanie Spear.
Hi, Lori. Yes, thanks so much.
EcoWatch is a terrific website, Stephanie, and I'm thinking that we might talk about some of the top environmental stories that have appeared on EcoWatch in 2012. You know, I'm sure you're familiar with Project Censored's annual project to highlight the most censored stories of the year, and I thought it might be worthwhile to highlight some of the top environmental stories of 2012 and why EcoWatch has featured some of them often and why. So you want to tell us something about some of the key stories of the year?
Sure. Well, my favorite of the year was Bloomberg Business Week's It's Global Warming Stupid. As maybe many of your listeners know, soon after Hurricane Sandy, the cover story for Bloomberg Business Week was the storyline, it's global warming stupid. And very soon after that came out on the cover, Mayor Michael Bloomberg endorsed President Barack Obama for re-election for president. Certainly, I think, you know, millions of people think of climate change a little differently now since Sandy and just really the summer that we've had with droughts and wildfires and flooding, high temperatures, highest temperatures that we've had in a very long time. So I think people are really beginning to connect the dots and understand that there is something called human-induced climate change and that we do impact the stability of our climate. So that story, I think, hit, you know, certainly mainstream and got a lot of people, you know, thinking.
How has that manifested itself on EcoWatch's website? Have you had lots of inquiries or more interest in issues of climate change and global warming?
You know, every day our network grows. It's really exciting. I've been publishing environmental news for 23 years, trying to get more people engaged and educated on these issues. So absolutely, you know, Hurricane Sandy, as well as the mainstream media covering some of these issues, has increased the popularity of EcoWatch, EcoWatch.org. We've been live for 14 months, which is relatively new in the online news media marketplace, but our network grows daily. You know, people are finally starting to make the connection between human health and the environment. This isn't just about making sure the birds and the bees are happy and healthy. This impacts our own health as well. Somewhat of a, you know, humanistic viewpoint, and I prefer people to really make the connection on an anthropocentric level. But, you know, we'll take it however we can get it. We need to make more people conscious of their impact on the earth and really understand the importance of biodiversity and the importance of making these issues a top priority, not only in our everyday life, but also on the political realm and making sure our elected officials make environmental issues a top priority.
And so those connections to human health, of course, are evident in some of your other top stories of the year, including the findings about toxins in a broad array of consumer products and in genetic engineering and food labeling.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Cincinnati passed a resolution requiring GE food labeling. You kind of have to read between the lines on that one. It doesn't mean that there's GE food labeling in Cincinnati, but they passed a resolution saying that they think there should be one. And many other cities are looking into similar resolutions. GMO foods, genetically modified organisms, is a huge issue. There's a piece we posted today about a historic lawsuit against Monsanto. Monsanto has these genetically modified seeds, and Monsanto is accusing farmers of using them, even though they're not. But because of the wind blows and seeds end up on these organic farms, there's been tons of controversy behind that. So there's definitely people conscious of their consumer products, the things they're bringing in their homes, the laundry detergent they're using in their house, what impact can that have on their family. So those connections are definitely being made. And so we did see a couple of the more consumer-type articles making our top 10 list of the year.
Well, another big story for 2012, of course, has been fracking. And on our show, the Old Mole Variety Hour, the Movie Moles here featured a review of some popular films, Promised Land and Gasland, that have brought to public attention the issue of fracking. What have been some of the critical stories regarding fracking in the last year?
Yeah, in our top 10 most read stories of 2012, four of them were fracking-related. So certainly a hot topic last year as well as this year. This week is a big week in New York as Governor Cuomo will be making his State of the State, and lots of anti-fracking activists are very busy working on different rallies and protests to try and keep the moratorium or a ban on fracking in that state. One of our most popular stories, our number two most read, dealt with frack sand. As probably many of your listeners know, you need, in order to frack a well for natural gas drilling, you need water, a lot of it, chemicals, toxic chemicals, as well as frack sand, silica sand. And Wisconsin and Minnesota are the states where frack sand is being mined. And so this article by Pilar Gerosimo talks about the impact that mining frack sand has had on the community. So they're going right into the communities and they're mining fertile farmland, land that certainly could grow healthy food for its frack sand. And the silica part of the sand is creates lots of health issues for the communities.
And so the impact of fracking is quite unbelievable. In addition to contributing to earthquakes and damaging water supplies, it's also in its accompanying industries, literally undermining huge chunks of land, as the article points out, in Minnesota and Wisconsin.
Yeah, it's so widespread, the different issues impacting communities' health and economy from fracking, and the frack sand certainly is one. As many people know, Promised Land went nationwide, opening in the theaters this last weekend, and there's lots of articles out there. We posted one today about the importance of Promised Land, but also the things that were not mentioned about impacts on communities from fracking. That's a post up on our site today. In addition, another big fracking piece that made our top 10 was about how fracking wastewater, the risk it poses to drinking water, groundwater contamination, and earthquakes. Not only do we have issues with fracking from the actual frack, when they go and they extract the natural gas, but then we have left over this toxic fracking wastewater that no one knows what to do with. Here in Ohio, I'm in Cleveland, we are injecting that toxic fracking wastewater that's radioactive, that's from going 8,000 feet below the ground, radioactivity comes back up, natural radioactivity comes back up with the frack water. And so in Ohio, we're injecting that water in injection wells. 50% of the water we're injecting comes from out of state. In other areas, they have other methods, but because it's radioactive, there's really no way to clean that water and put it back to the water table. So it is forever gone from our water table.
Well, Stephanie, there's lots of depressing news about the environment and the planet and the state of the planet. But EcoWatch also publishes some very encouraging news. And in our remaining minute, do you want to say something about some of the activism that's leading to changes in protecting the planet?
Yeah, absolutely. Our sixth most read story of the year was telling Congress to expedite renewable energy. There's no doubt we have another pathway to create a sustainable world that is, healthy for our economy and for people and other creatures. So we have many people posting great petitions on our site to create change. In addition, we're happy to report that the wind tax for the PTC, the production tax credit for wind farms was passed by Congress, which was a positive story. We also have a lot of articles on sustainable agriculture, local foods, different ways that we can feed people that doesn't harm the environment. So there are a lot of encouraging stories. We cover a world wide view on these issues, so we have a lot of exciting articles on our renewables page. You're able to view news on EcoWatch by topic. So our renewable page talks about different communities going 100% renewable, how they're able to reduce their carbon footprint and go green. We also, we promote the work of 1,000 grassroots groups worldwide, so you really get a wide range of the different people and organizations out there who are working to make a difference.
Well, thank you so much, Stephanie Penn Spear, for joining us today on the Old Mole Show, and want to direct listeners again to Stephanie Spear's article, Story of the Year, It's Global Warming Stupid, which appears on Huffington Post, a number of websites, as well as the website ecowatch.org. Thanks very much, Stephanie.
Thanks so much. Have a great day.
Black smoke in the Brazilian sky. Forest burns, the angels cry, things die. One by one, they leave this earth with each setting sun. We try to close our eyes, to paint the shadows with our daily lives.
Vampires and zombies abound these days in popular culture and in the culture of the market. In 2009, journalist Matt Taibbi famously dubbed the investment bank Goldman Sachs a great vampire squid wrapped around the face of humanity, relentlessly jamming its blood funnel into anything that smells like money. Some consumers face zombie debt that creditors continue to demand long after it has expired or been written off. Regular listeners to The Mole may recall the long history of these metaphorical horrors, including Karl Marx's description of capital as dead labor that, vampire-like, only lives by sucking living labor and lives the more labor it sucks. But if capital is vampiric, like the aristocratic Count Dracula with his new property in England, then members of the laboring classes are historically associated with zombies. These emerged in Haitian voodoo, where the zombie is a reanimated corpse enslaved to a zombie master. In folk culture, peasants have sometimes explained their wealthier neighbors as zombie masters. The 1932 movie White Zombie features Bela Lugosi as a mill owner whose workers are zombies. These associations go some way to explaining why zombies and vampires are among the monsters that concern David McNally in his timely and engaging book, Monsters of the Market, Zombies, Vampires, and Global Capitalism, available in paperback from Haymarket Press. McNally affirms that vampires and zombies, quote, need to be thought conjointly as interconnected moments of the monstrous dialectic of modernity. The vampire and the zombie are doubles, linked poles of the split society. If vampires are the dreaded beings who might possess us and turn us into their docile servants, zombies represent our haunted self-image, warning us that we might already be lifeless, disempowered agents of alien powers. McNally has little to say about the flesh-eating ghouls of George Romero's movies, and nothing at all to say about the sparkly vampires of Stephanie Meyer's Twilight or their ancestors in the suffering aristocrats of Anne Rice stories, though his argument has provocative implications for understanding these figures. Instead, McNally addresses the ways that corporeal horror emerges from the nature of capitalism, including from the denigration of the physical inherent in the notion of abstract labor and of value as an abstraction from the physical form of any commodity. McNally locates the emergence of corporeal horror in historical eras of enclosure and fragmentation of space and the body. The first of his three long central chapters surveys the history of early modern Britain, the process of the enclosures of common land and privatization of common resources, and the use of public dissection and anatomy as punishments for the poor. People were cut off from access to land and thus forced to become wage workers, detached parts, as in the expression factory hands. Those who resisted the market were criminalized for stealing the very things to which common folk had once had recognized rights. And the bodies of those executed could be publicly dissected in a days-long spectacle that McNally notes served not scientific exploration, but as a civic display of bourgeois rule enacted on the bodies of paupers and criminals, a ritual designed to inscribe social control over the bodies of the laboring poor. The relevant monster in this chapter is Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, notably quite different from his cinematic incarnations because he not only speaks, but speaks eloquently. The third chapter of Monsters of the Market surveys recent anthropological work on the stories of witchcraft, vampires, zombies, and other body horror in parts of the world more recently drawn into the globalizing capitalist process, particularly sub-Saharan Africa. For instance, Nigerian cinema, Nollywood, is now the world's third largest film industry and has produced hundreds of voodoo horror movies that turn on stories of blood sacrifice and ritual dismemberment in the interests of accumulation. McNally argues that the 20th century African tales of vampires and other monsters are ways of trying to understand the mysteries of capitalist relations, in which land is enclosed, privatized, and commodified, time as well as space is fragmented and regularized, and individualism and market relations supplant traditional systems of kinship and community. In between these two chapters, McNally reads Marx's use of Gothic metaphors as crucial to his account of capitalism as an occult system, one that makes work invisible. This monstrous exploitation of living labor occurs in the hidden abode of production, where the sale of life activity as commodified labor power alienates the workers from themselves. The value embodied in the manufactured commodity or the commodified service is an abstraction from the things themselves or the concrete labor involved in them. The capitalist economy thus effects a real abstraction in which products become bearers of an invisible substance, value, and concrete labor becomes the bearer of labor in the abstract. The Latin root of the verb to abstract means literally to separate, detach, cut off. This abstraction is what Marx calls the secret of the fetishism of commodities and figures among the tropes of cutting, dismemberment, disembodiment, and bodily horror woven throughout Marx's account of capitalism and McNally's account of the monsters of the market. The book's central chapter also contains as clear an account as I've seen of the processes of financialization and the mechanisms of hedge funds, derivatives, credit default swaps, and other mysteries of financial speculation. Stressing that, quote, beneath the esoteric circuits of finance lie material practices of plunder of the world's resources and its laborers, end quote, McNally elucidates the nature of fictitious capital, that which is derived not from the congealed labor of the past, but from the possible labor of the future, the interest-bearing capital that hides its detour through work that has not yet been done, surplus value that has not yet been extracted, claims on future wealth that may or may not be realized. In making visible these mysteries, these tales of vampires and zombies, like Marx's theory, can help us see the truly monstrous nature of capitalism, and in seeing it, move to change it. Monsters of the Market has much to offer lovers of monster stories interested in their early roots and global resonance, as well as anyone looking for a lucid account of the more mysterious manifestations of capitalism. McNally argues near the end of Monsters of the Market, quote, Marx saw the key to unions and workers' organization not in their strictly material achievements, but rather in the spirit of opposition they cultivated. Without struggle, resistance, and international organization, he argued, workers risked becoming apathetic, thoughtless, more or less well-fed instruments of production. In short, zombies who cannot awaken. Until that awakening, monstrous utopia lives on in stories, dreams, music, art, and moments of resistance that prefigure the grotesque movements through which the collective laborer throws off its zombified state in favor of something new, frightening, and beautiful, end quote. For The Old Mole, this has been Fran Michel reviewing David McNally's Monsters of the Market, Zombies, Vampires, and Global Capitalism.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, and that was Fela Kuti's Zombie, following Fran Michel's review of David McNally's book, Monsters of the Market, Zombies, Vampires, and Global Capitalism. Now, the movie moles Denise Morris and Jan Hocken offer a feminist analysis of the recent Newtown, Connecticut shooting and the larger issue of gun violence.
Thanks, Lori. Yes, we're just 3 weeks removed from the December 14th shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary in Newtown, Connecticut, and the gun control debate is, of course, in full swing, and the media continues to report on any new details regarding shooter Adam Lanza's personality and behavior with hope of making sense of what seems so senseless. We moles want to ask this morning, what is available to us to help explain these events in thoughtful and critical ways? This morning, we look back at Michael Moore's 2002 documentary film, Bowling for Columbine, and we'll examine and expand on some of the key questions raised in the film. Bowling for Columbine takes up the shooting spree at Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado, and Moore's interest in getting to the roots of the massacre. But as we see throughout the film, there are really no easy causal explanations for why this shooting and others before and after it happened. Availability of guns, violence in the media and video games, demonic rock stars, poverty, mental illness routinely pop up in mainstream narratives about why mass shootings occur. And in Bowling for Columbine, Moore really does spend considerable time exploring our culture of fear, racism, militarism, and the lack of a secure social welfare system as contributors to why most believe this is a growing problem in the U.S. And Jan, what's really good about this film, as opposed to what we hear mostly in mainstream media, is that the film really takes a position against narrow single-cause narratives to explain these shootings, and this really is a good thing.
Yeah, and it brings the expected frustrations accompanied by such an analysis that's not easily reduced to a single reform. I mean, the film begins with his own identification with the gun culture in Michigan, and it's quite funny and seems to have an element of parody of small town people where you can go into a bank, open an account, and get a free gun, and that typical Michael Moore way, and then he moves quite ominously into from American gun culture, rural gun culture, particularly to the history of militarism and the kind of the successive bombings of other countries steadily year after year to foreground the hypocrisy of some of the outrage and horror that young men take up and identify with a kind of a commando position and kill a bunch of people. But then he successively moves through different arguments, including that the ready availability of guns is a cause, even questioning poverty is a cause, and the argument that somehow the availability of guns is a primary determinant. I mean, he one by one debunks conventional explanations and moving more toward, and I think he's right in a sense, a broader social analysis related to fear, that fear of other people and a sense of alienation people have from one another and fear of the government is a primary force behind the market for guns. And I think implicit in that line of analysis is an idea that isn't developed, I think, sufficiently, and that is that there is a potential always for violence and that how people deal with their anxieties and fears is primary. And it's not, he doesn't at all see this as an issue related to the mentally ill, which often is one way of narrating these tragedies, is that there's a few very crazy people who need to be somehow brought under control that has nothing to do with all of the good people who are the victims of this.
Well, that's an important piece of this for both of us, Jan, since you have spent many years as a clinical psychologist doing a lot of your work around your film documentary work yourself around mental health issues and teaching as you did at Portland State for many years. You've really thought through these questions, one point you raised is that, you know, mental health predictors are not so easily had. And in fact, this connection that we make between mental illness and mass shootings is actually quite problematic.
Yeah, and spurious. Indeed, the young man, the perpetrator in the Newtown massacre, has been either diagnosed or suspected to suffer from Asperger, which is considered a high-level functioning form of autism, or exhibits many of the symptoms associated with that syndrome. And that diagnosis, particularly people within the autism spectrum, typically have a very low level of aggression. And this is extremely unusual for someone with those characteristics. So to spin a whole mental health program around the particulars of this situation are irresponsible, and I think it's a bad sign that these still unusual tragedies, because they are relatively infrequent, become the impetus for a mental health system that is indeed, like so much of our social welfare system, a pretty raggedy safety net at this point. I mean, most people who suffer from mental health issues are more likely to be victimized than victimizers or perpetrators, and most lead undramatic and quiet lives of suffering. So there's also, I think, a question here of what these enormous spectacles that are indeed upsetting and horrible tragedies, what their role is in our public narratives on social problems, and why the reliance on these high drama cases to address these chronic issues, including the number of people who are shot by firearms and die every day that far exceed these massacres.
One of the more challenging topics to kind of dig into, and what I think what we're saying is, you know, there are burdens that come with trying to have a more systemic analysis, and that means that at times we may sound insensitive. We should really remind people that these things are horrifying, and to understand them is very complex. One of those pieces is, you know, this question about what is the surprise around violence, and particularly in areas like Newtown, which are perceived to be sort of wholesome areas, quiet, tranquil, well-funded, you know,
the heart
loving.
And soul of America.
The heart and soul of America, as opposed to what we might see in some of our urban areas where there's much more negligence, neglect of social services, job loss, all of the, you know, the many things that come with the downside of our economic system. So, you discovered, Jan, something about Newtown that kind of is a marker, or at least a metaphor, for why these idealizing narratives are actually quite they cover a lot. There's a veil of innocence often in these situations.
Yeah, that's. I think one way to look at these tragedies is both through the lens of what we can understand of determinants, and I think Michael Moore is right that any single explanation, including regulation of weapons, is as important as it is insufficient, and also the potential even within the left to either exploit or anxiously respond to a crisis in a narrow way, but the other way to look at them is how they're cast in these narratives that follow. And certainly the little town and the new town tragedies shared this drama by exposing the small town as not a place of idyllic innocence as it seemed, although although part of the way the media narrated the tragedy is because it was so innocent, because these were people who embodied the kind of wholesome heartland that it made it especially tragic. But in actuality, the center of the organization called SAMI, the Small Arms and Ammunition Manufacturing Institute, is based there. And so that's a story for another day, that kind of underside of small town, wholesome American life.
Right. So we certainly have probably raised more questions than answered. But as we do as moles, we want to
keep
be thoughtful, yeah, and generate more thoughtful discussion on these topics. I'm Denise Morris. I've been with Jan Hocken this morning. We were looking back a little bit at Michael Moore's film Bowling for Columbine and trying to make sense of mass shootings and our culture of violence in the U.S.
And the film's available online to watch for free. Certainly worth revisiting.
Absolutely.
Very timely still.
Yeah.
That was Midnight Oil, Put Down That Weapon. And we heard from Denise Morris and Jan Hocken discussing gun violence and Michael Moore's older film, Bowling for Columbine, still relevant today. Next, Bill Resnick speaks with Jacob Devaney, founder and director of Culture Collective and contributor to the Huffington Post, about recent struggles of First Nations Canadian women to prevent corporations from weakening Indigenous treaty rights.
Jacob Devaney, welcome to KABU.
Thank you very much, Bill. It's good to be on today.
Jacob Devaney is a founder and director of the Culture Collective in Los Angeles. He's a pianist, a performer, producer, writer, does a lot on environmental protection. I encountered Jacob Devaney while reading of his piece, a recent one in the Huffington Post, on the Native Canadian movement. It's called Idle No More. He discusses Idle No More's appeal to youth and people everywhere and different ways that separate movements are learning from each other and how they share similar core passions. Jacob, first describe Idle No More.
Well, in a nutshell, it's a complex situation, but in a nutshell, it was started by four ladies, Nina Wilson, Sylvia McAdam, Jessica Gordon, and Sheila McLean. And they felt it was urgent to act on current and upcoming legislation that not only affects First Nations people in Canada, but the rest of Canadian citizens. And I chimed in because I realized that what they're standing up for doesn't even only affect Canadian citizens. This is a pretty global, universal issue that needs to be addressed even beyond Canada. So that's where I kind of came in.
And part of it, of course, is that this legislation in Canada, which is taking away treaty rights, is forcing the First Nations of Canada to cede and give land to the various corporate predators who are so active now in Canada, not just in the lumber industry and not just in the agriculture, but the tar sands people are very interested in making sure that the Native Canadians cannot, in fact, infringe on and somehow impact their planet-destroying operation.
I like the way you put it there. And, you know, there's a lot of planet-destroying operations that are happening everywhere, and there's a lot of exploitation that is happening. And that, I guess exploitation could be when a wealthy country exploits a less wealthy country, when a strong person exploits a not-as-strong person. or when a dominant or colonial government exploits indigenous people. And so, of course, this situation is a big deal in Canada, and it's also a big deal all over the world right now. And it's threatening the well-being of our planet. And I think that's a pretty important issue to give some attention to. So I really appreciate you having me today.
Right. It sparked protests around the world, actually. I mean, it has really caught on, even in Portland, in fact, that for Portlanders, at the Lloyd Center, there was a drumming ceremony last Friday. I call it a flash mob. It was really a very public event showing solidarity with those people in Canada who are trying to stop this rape of the planet. It's happening everywhere.
One thing I can say about the gatherings that I find very hopeful and beautiful is that most of the flash mobs are not even specifically protests. They're round dances. People show up with hoop drums and start pounding a hoop drum and singing a native song and dancing. And I think that's really beautiful. You always hear the quote, if dancing isn't going to be part of the revolution, I don't want to be part of it. So I think that's beautiful, and they really have a strong commitment to having their needs met nonviolently, which I think is also beautiful. And they're also very much employing social media, Twitter, Facebook, blogging, and so forth. As I write for the Huffington Post, and the article that I just most recently did is called Idle No More, Hints of a Global Super Movement. And so I did an article that just kind of brings attention to Idle No More and also takes note of so many other things that are happening. I don't think it's all too different from the Occupy movement that was happening here in the country. That had to do a little bit more with maybe specifically financial exploitation. But it really all boils down to the same thing in the end. You hear it a lot lately because of a lot of issues, this notion of rape culture. It's really colonial culture is what it is. It's a domination culture. And I think that that's really what it's, you know, hopefully what people are wanting to have addressed everywhere, for just mutual respect to the land, to indigenous people, and so forth. In the 90s in Canada, there was the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples. You know, what they did is they looked for fair foundations and honorable relationship between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people of Canada. 20 years later, nothing has happened towards that. And with the C-45 bill, people have just had it. And I can relate. I've kind of had it myself. So there's a female chief, Teresa Spence, is on a hunger strike. This coming January 11th will be 1 month, and there will be acts in solidarity all over the world with her message. So that's very exciting. I get to see a little bit of Gandhi technique, nonviolent technique, fasting, civil disobedience happening, and it's beautiful to see people joining in all over.
Yeah, the 11th is this coming Friday, and I'm sure there will be things in Portland. Keep track of Cable will be announcing them. This is KBOO Radio, Bill Resnick for The Old Mole, talking to Jacob Devaney, who's been reporting on Idle No More in the Huffington Post, and discusses it as one of so many struggles around the world with common themes. Let's conclude this interview talking about those sort of core values that you've identified and that are clearly there, not just in the industrialized world, but really everywhere. There are people actually rising up in across the planet. Talk about it.
Well, I think that this social media is a big part of it. We've seen here recently in the country with the anonymous exposing a group of football players that raped a teenage girl. And so you see people employing technology to bring about justice. And the more people do that, the more it becomes apparent lots of times how much the people who are supposed to be doing that aren't doing their jobs. And so social media is a big part of it. Twitter was a big part of the Arab Spring, also a big part of Occupy movement. Even Facebook is really an opportunity for people to have civil discourse, which is a very important part of democracy and a free world, is People need to be informed. People need to be able to agree, to disagree on occasion, to be able to disagree respectfully, but really to listen to each other. And there's a lot, there's an environmental movement speaking about climate change. There are economic, social justice, so many movements. I think that one thing they all share in common is they do not feel like they're really being heard. And by the governments that are supposed to represent their best interests.
Yeah, you know, there's another part of it, I think, that really should be highlighted. It's not only they're not being heard, but in fact, they weren't ever part of the policy making in the world that's shaping their lives. I think all of those movements have this strong current of seeking genuine democracy, not just electoral democracy, and not just talking to your, quote, representatives or to the various elites and petitioning them to do something, but in fact, on-the-ground democracy, people treating one another with respect and, in fact, having a voice in the institutions of their life, like the workplace and throughout social life, in families, in local organizations.
And I think the internet is giving us that opportunity. It's not a hierarchical form of discussion. It is a the playing field is level, and governments need to be able to start acknowledging that we're not living in a colonial world anymore, and we're not willing to wait passively while the natural resources that sustain all of life are in jeopardy. And of course, we need fuel, we need energy, we need these things, but we need to be able to do it in a way that respects indigenous culture and respects nature. You can't just clear-cut forests for 100 years and expect to hand a better world to your grandchildren. It just doesn't work that way.
Or burn fossil fuels and change the climate. Jacob Devaney, thanks a lot for talking to us. Keep up the good work.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Right, so long.
Thank you, Bill and Jacob Devaney. That concludes the Old Mole Variety Hour. And we also heard today from teacher and activist Brian Jones, appearing this Friday in Portland, Stephanie Penn Spear of EcoWatch.org, and the Movie Moles, Denise Morris and Jan Hocken, reviewing Michael Moore's film Bowling for Columbine, and Fran Michelle, who reviewed David McNally's Monsters of the Market, Zombies, Vampires, and Global Capitalism. You can hear all of our reviews, interviews, and views, and this broadcast again anytime on the KBOO Old Mole Variety Hour website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. This is Lori Mercier. Thanks so much to Carlos Chavez for engineering today. And coming up next on KBOO, we have at 10 o'clock Chris Andre hosting Air Cascadia. At 10:15 on Locus Focus, host Barbara Bernstein talks with climate scientist Todd Sanford about the public health impacts of climate change-induced storms such as Sandy and how to build more resilient communities. Health Watch will not be on today. Instead, we will hear Food Sleuth Radio, which features an interview with Andy Fisher at 11 o'clock. And at 11:30 on Madness Radio, speed skate champion Megan Busson describes her ordeal of trauma and eating disorders and how her medications only made her worse. Thanks to KBOO members for your generous support in 2012 and best wishes in 2013.
morning, Cascadia. Today is January 7th, 2013, and you are listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. A little night work in Pioneer Courthouse Square yesterday evening, and in Houston, over 100 Tar Sands blockade protesters are right now taking over the lobby of the Trans-Canada building in Houston. We'll be speaking with Ron Seifert, who is right there at the die-in now. Meanwhile, the nominations juggernaut rolls ahead. Obama has tapped John Waterboard Brennan as the next CIA director, and Republicans are rallying the troops in an attempt to defeat Chuck Hagel's nomination as our next Secretary of Defense. Weather, rain likely today, cloudy, highs near 50. A little bit of a southwest wind around 14 miles an hour, but it could gust up to 22 miles per hour if it gets going. Tonight, rain likely again with a low around 43. In fact, for the next few days, do expect rain. And tomorrow it is likely again to be a wet one with a high near 52. South winds are around 15 miles per hour, gusting as high as 24 miles per hour. For tomorrow night, more rain, lows around 42, and those southwest winds ginning up to 15 to 17 and possibly even as high as 28 miles per hour. For the alternative outlook, we have a waning crescent flower moon in